John, you've raised some fascinating issues with this scenario, and let's break down some of them a little bit more specifically. And I'd like to start with the scenario that gets us up to 10,000 feet. Some pilots have been exposed to physiological training, most have not. What are some of the challenges that we face as we increase our altitude, and what are some of the different thresholds we need to be aware of as we increase our altitude to comply with a given scenario?
Well, that's a good point. In this example, we didn't really specify whether or not we had onboard oxygen, but that would be a definite consideration. And what have we told our passengers? Have we told our passengers that they may be required to use oxygen? Have we demonstrated it to them? What's the capacity of our system? There's a lot of factors that need to go into looking at this flight. And plus the physiological impact, as you said, of flying at 10, 12, 14,000 feet. Oxygen may or may not be legally required at this point, but we're certainly looking at degraded performance of both us as a pilot and the impact it's going to have on our passengers.
Also the fatigue factor, 10, 12, 14,000, maybe legal, but a heck of a lot of fatigue will set in on a four-hour flight.
Absolutely, that's true. And there's another factor, and that's dehydration. Flying at high altitude, the body loses moisture. And that contributes to bad judgment and other issues. So it adds another one to the I'm safe formula. It adds a bit of an illness. You're dehydrated.
And I think, you know, generally pilots need to accept that most pilots are not well educated in physiological aspects of flying. The military stresses it very strongly. In my Air Force background and training, I went through a several weeks course in physiological training alone during undergraduate pilot training, and then had to go back every couple of years for refresher training just because it's that important and has that much of an impact on our flying. So we need to recognize that as we increase altitude, it's going to affect performance. How is it going to affect our performance? Well, maybe we need to do a little bit more research and background ourselves to make ourselves aware of these challenges and the issues. I know that people that go to Denver and in high altitude locations find that they tire much quicker as we do things, as we try to perform normal functions with an increase in altitude.
That's a good point. Would you have any good suggestions on how the average GA pilot might prepare themselves for this?
Well, it's getting harder and harder. I know that with Air Force bases closing down all around the country, I know at the military bases and the FAA in Oklahoma City used to open up their physiological training facilities to civilians as opportunities permitted. So I would encourage people to do this, any chance that they have. If there's an Air Force base or a base nearby with an altitude chamber, oh boy, it's dramatic and graphic in just how important it is, the use of oxygen, how we perform. And the trouble is with hypoxia, it's insidious. It sneaks up on us. You don't realize you're losing capacity. And you can literally sit there and watch people, you know, not knowing what they're doing anymore. So and everybody has different physiological symptoms. And you need to understand your own physiological symptoms so that you can respond accordingly in that scenario.
Bob, there's also a commercial application now. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University is offering high-altitude training at their place, and I'll bet there'll be others out there. That's how important it is.
It is crucial. And once again, unless you've been there in the altitude chamber and see the tingling and the loss of, literally it can take you right up to a loss of consciousness, which is obviously the extreme, but you need to recognize your symptoms so you can either descend or go on oxygen as appropriate.
As one who flew over the Sierras in the Skyhawk at 13,500 feet, although legal because we weren't up there for more than 30
right.
minutes, I remember the blue fingernails and the headache I had when we finally landed. And that headache just hung on. We landed at an airport that was about 4,500 foot field elevation and just couldn't seem to get rid of the headache. And I wasn't up there all that long either.
And I'll throw in one other element, Bob. If any of you or your passengers are flying with even a small head cold, descending from altitudes, you run into an ear block. And thank God I've never had one, but they're about as painful as anything that you can experience. And if you or one of your passengers start experiencing an ear block, what are you going to do now?
Big problem.
Yeah.
But what really concerns me here is planning the reroutes. To fly single pilot, and I think, John, you alluded to this,
yeah.
to put in three different flight plans and figure out what the elapsed time was and then make a decision and get back to ATC, that's pretty tough. You almost have to boil it down to a couple choices. One, turn around and go back and do it another day, or land at the nearest convenient airport on your route, replan it, refuel, and then go on your way. I think those are the two choices. I'm not a real fan of going up to 10 or 12,000 with a potential of maybe having to go to 14 or 16 if we have oxygen to get over buildups. That's just tough for the passengers, and maybe the pilot's a little bit more inclined to do it and accustomed to it. But if you've got passengers on board, if they're not pilots and they haven't done it, you're asking a lot. You're just taking the joy out of the flight and creating anxiety that is really not worthwhile.
You hit on something there with the pre-flight, and maybe we could talk about that a little bit more. I mean, we're jumping off an airport just outside a major metropolitan area with a VFR departure, expecting to fly through another major metropolitan area, and without really doing any research. How would you research this flight to make sure that you don't get hit with the three different reroutes right off the ground? Basically, you know, you've departed the pattern, and all of a sudden you got this situation you got to deal with.
Well, you know, sometimes you'll file a flight plan, it'll go into the system, and the system may not know the peculiarities of the airspace you're going through. So one of the best things you can do is look at, and I think you mentioned it, go to flightplan.com, for instance, and look at routes that have been planned by other aircraft. And usually if you're in frequently used airspace, you'll see a lot of routes in there.
But it goes back to you can't plan too much.
You can't plan too much. The other thing you can do, if you don't have access to the computer, if you've got a airport facility directory, look at the tower route control routes, TEC routes.
Yeah.
Look at preferred routes if they apply, although preferred routes are generally higher altitude routes. What we're looking at here at 8,000 feet would probably be tower and route pairs. Take a look and see what's there. So there's a couple ways you can get an idea of what you might expect in terms of routing. And then you'll be in a little better position to file a route, and you'll know before you leave that you're running up against fuel issues. You're at minimum fuel before you leave on some of these routes.
And the plan has changed quite a bit from what you thought it was going to be.
That's
to what
right.
It really turned
exactly.
out
Exactly. So those are a couple ideas out of how to establish what a route might be. The other thing might be to ask at the airport. Many times there's people who can give you some hints as to what you can expect on a routing.
Yep.
You know, simply ask the question, what kind of routing do you normally get from this airport to go south of New York City?
Yep. Very good.
Bob, you raise another, I think, very important factor, too. And that is, you know, we try to advocate in flying to always be ahead of the airplane, always be ahead of the airplane. Well, when you get a rerouting, you are instantly behind the airplane. So you have to catch up with the airplane before you can get back ahead again. And this just takes time. And maybe the best way to do that, you know, is ask for a turn in holding or do something to allow you to catch back up with your airplane again. And the choices you gave were very relevant. It may be to go back to where you were, more comfortable environment. You know what the weather is behind you. You know what the fixes are behind you. Or, you know, just deciding, I'm going to land and figure this out on the ground. It's a lot easier figuring this out over a planning table than it is trying to fly the airplane, think, and get ahead at the same time.
Also, if you're expecting to fly through the New York area with thunderstorms, you ought to plan on a reroute from the beginning.
And, you know, it's one thing. We're talking about the New York airspace, and I'll just throw out here, you know, and I have the utmost respect for air traffic control, personnel and the great support they provide pilots. But sometimes the New York air traffic controllers are accused of being a little brusque. Well, for whatever reason, that's just reality. But pilots can be intimidated by this. It just goes along with the knowledge of the airspace you're in, and be smart before you get there. Any thoughts on that?
And be ahead of things. I mean, really, it all comes down to being ahead of your airplane. That's why it concerns me putting in three different flight plans, trying to fly the airplane, talk to air traffic control, and come up with which routing is going to be best. I don't want to undertake that. I'm going to land at Worcester or Bradley. or maybe even turn around and go back to the departure point and just put it on the ground.
But it can't be difficult to explain it to the passengers that you've just talked into going on this ride with you. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, why are we turning around and going back?
Maybe that's something you need to cover in your pre-flight briefing with your passengers. That you are the pilot in command and you'll be making some decisions that might cause you to deviate from whatever routing you thought you were going to take or whatever itinerary you were planning on working with. So you might want to tell them ahead of time that things don't always go according to plan.
And that's a good point about the pre-flight briefing, too. You may want to talk to them a little bit beforehand and just say, there may be times that I need to talk on the radio here, and I need a couple of minutes, and you guys just need to be quiet.
Yeah, passengers need to know, A, how they can help you, and B, how they can hurt you. And you will determine in how professional your briefing is just what role they take on. Every mission that I flew in years of military flying started out with a briefing.
And giving a good passenger briefing, I think, puts the passengers at ease to some extent.
Yeah.
You're going to tell them a little bit about the airplane. It might simply be how to open the doors. You're going to talk about what altitude you're going to be flying at, what route. Some of those kinds of things will, I think, put them a little bit at ease. It's not a complete mystery as to what's going to be happening.
Absolutely. How about your own briefing to yourself? You know, we've all flown in multi-pilot crews where you do a departure briefing and you say, okay, you know, if we have an engine failure after takeoff, this is what we're going to do and stuff. How about if you're by yourself, do you do a briefing to yourself? You may even do it out loud, or you just may say, if something happens, this is what I'm going to do. It's much easier to talk it out beforehand. I mean, what are some of the strategies that you guys do when you're single pilot?
The same circumstances exist. The same duties have to be accomplished. So getting organized, running your own checklist, and everything you do on the ground will help prepare you for what's going to happen in flight. You know, the prior planning prevents poor performance, and very few of us have ever over-prepared for a flight.
Well said, Bob.
Let me just shift gears here for a second, okay, because I think, you know, we've had numerous discussions about legal versus safe. Okay, this is legal, but it's not safe. This is safe, but it's not legal. I'd like to throw in there one more element into that discussion, and we have legal versus safe versus smart, okay? And so legal is pretty black and white. You know, we can look up the regulations and find out whether something is legal. Well, is something safe? Well, I think, you know, it's not quite as clearly defined as the regulations, but I think most of us have a box that we can throw safe into. Well, what is smart? What are some of the determinants that we want to use as pilots to make sure that we make smart decisions to ensure success?
And that's being ahead of the airplane.
Good.
By the pre-flight planning, so that when stuff does happen, you're ready for it. It could be in this scenario, just having the charts out. It could be your cockpit organization. There's nothing in the regs that say that you got to be organized in your cockpit, but it certainly is smart. You know, being smart, as you said, asking around at the airport before you leave. What kind of routing can you expect out of here? It's those kinds of little things that get us to that higher level as pilots.
One of the elements that I think is so crucial and we mismanage terribly as pilots is time. You know, allowing enough time to do it right. In the flying mode, you know, we all tend to try to pack 10 pounds into a 5-pound bag, and allowing extra time for pre-flight, extra time to get the clearance, extra time for almost every element, I think will avoid building up the pressures that create the stress and the anxiety that lead to, you know, the tumbling house of cards.
Well, certainly in this scenario, the time element is there. The original plan was to leave right after lunch. Didn't get to the airport until 4 p.m. So 4 hours behind the plan to start with. Now, certainly there's got to be some stress there, and there's got to be some shortcuts being employed to get off the ground.
Exactly.
And I think they're showing up once you get into the air, in this case, when the issue of the routing comes up.
I think this scenario, John, is a great example of a rolling aeronautical decision-making process. First, your plan changed right after takeoff.
Yep.
Now you've got to make an aeronautical decision about the route. That's a pretty big one. Then after you've selected that, you've got to decide, am I going to accept 44 minutes in one case of reserve fuel, or am I going to make an alternate plan and land somewhere? then where shall I land? And now you need to add in the factors of food and fatigue, and maybe there's a motel there, maybe there isn't. This decision-making process just keeps rolling. Now that you've landed at someplace, am I too fatigued to go on? Is it night now? Am I current at night? I think it's a great example of how these little straws on, as Bob said, the straws build up on the camel's back, and eventually there's one too many.
And it started out as a fairly benign, you probably could have even done a trip VFR, you know?
Yeah.
There was plenty of VFR airports around.
Which, by the way, I liked your suggestion. I would have considered that. I would have gotten out of the New York area and around the weather, and then I would have at least evaluated the possibility of going VFR.
Right, which opens up some options. But when we first look at this on the surface, it's not a very challenging flight. And within a few minutes, it went dramatically downhill and all of a sudden became very challenging.
Well, the change from IFR to VFR, if you were to make it, is not without its hazards. We've got the issue of TFRs.
Yep. The ATAs.
ATAs, which is in the way on that trip down. These things would be transparent to you if you remained on an IFR flight plan. If you go VFR, well, have you briefed on TFRs and the ATAs?
Yeah.
Do you have are you qualified to fly near the ATAs? Right. Have you done your ATAs security training?
Do you have the proper VFR
charts? VFR. Do you have the proper VFR charts? A whole bunch of other issues now come into play once you cancel an IFR flight plan.
Right.
And you're certainly in a pickle if you're not able to make a frequency change to the next controller and they won't take you at some point along the route as VFR traffic because they're too busy. What do you do then?
Or you run into weather again.
Yeah.
The forecast was for clear, but who knows, you run into a broken deck or something.
Absolutely, John.
And now you got to work your way back down through it.
So that's not without its hazards.
Pros and cons, exactly.
Yes.
And that's what we do as pilots.
You're balancing.
And we're making decisions.
Yes.
But if we go back to what Bob was saying, you know, and that's being smart. You're evaluating that decision. You're perfectly legal to be
VFR.
Right? Okay.
Is it safe?
It's safe.
Maybe if you prepped and you had the charts. And you had a good briefing, which would
and
give you the information you would need.
We said that we had Datalink weather on board, so we could continue to watch the weather ahead.
Right.
And if station's reporting clear, the forecast is clear.
And if our subscription provided TFR information, that would help as well.
Yep.
The other point I'll put out, too, is that I think with good information, we make good decisions. And so using the incredible weather information that is available to us to be looking down the line, okay? So you're not reacting, you're being proactive rather than reactive. Reactive is always going to take a lot longer. If you know what the weather to anticipate in 30 minutes, you'll have a plan for what's going to happen when you get there, as opposed to arriving at the bad weather and then having to react to that. The other thing that struck me from your scenario, John, is how often you refer to the word fuel. Well, it becomes overriding. Well, who controls how much fuel we have on the airplane? Well, look in the mirror. We do, okay? And so many times, well, fuel's too expensive here. I want to put on just the minimum or whatever. We have so many different ways, but I'll tell you what, there's no more stressful element in an airplane than being focused on the fuel gauges.
Exactly.
And that's a distraction like no other. So we really want to remove that, you know, as a distraction. Now, it doesn't say that you carry, you know, so much fuel that you can't climb to an altitude, but fuel is truly an element that we need to manage effectively.
Right, and any distraction like that or any particular thing you focus on, whether it's fuel or might be a mechanical issue, you know, how many times have you got the old automatic rough over the water or something like that? But now this fuel thing starts clouding our decision-making, and we're starting to make our decisions based on our fuel anxiety. And we may accept a routing through an area or through some weather because we're worried about the fuel. That's actually going to turn out worse. So
it acts as an obsession, and it occupies too much of your brain.
Right.
When you should be doing other things, you're looking at the fuel gauges.
Right.
So it's totally unnecessary. That's a good time to put it down, get more fuel.
If you're worrying about your fuel,
yes,
if it's,
you,
if
you
it's
don't
occupying
have enough.
Your time, you don't have enough. So go get some.
Exactly, Wally.
Another great example of being proactive, and I'm always taken by this. Every time I've done an in-route cockpit inspection on the airliners, I can't get over how proactive the pilot and the first officer are with regard to flight turbulence and avoiding turbulence. I mean, they're always asking for flight reports, soliciting information so that they can give the passengers in the back of the airplane the best ride. And it works. I mean, most of the flights, and some days you just can't get there from here, but that doesn't mean the pilots aren't always working on that. And once again, with prior planning, you can avoid the areas where the known turbulence exists.
That's why in this particular scenario, the fact you have passengers on board, that brings the turbulence issue into play. Many pilots are immune to turbulence. They'll fly through it. But if you've got passengers on board, it's a different story.
And we have pyrups of turbulence already.
Yes,
we
know
do. It's coming up.
We know it's coming.
You give a great point there, John. And pyrups, we should give them. We should solicit them. If you encounter unanticipated weather, unanticipated events, pass them along to other pilots and actively solicit pyrups so that you have the best information available.